Harold, are you ready?
I'm ready anytime.
First, I want to go into a little background.
Sure.
Now, Sandy joined the Neighborhood Playhouse, do you recall, in 1936?
1935 or 36, I don't know which of them. I always thought it was 35, but I could be wrong.
I read it in the encyclopedia, it was 36. No. Do you remember anything about that?
Well, I wasn't around,
of course.
Can
you recollect anything?
No, nothing that I heard about those, very little about those early days. Maybe a little through Paul Morrison, that would be my only connection with those few things that Paul had said about those early days when Sandy was. I know that Paul said that Sandy did a lot of work on Shakespeare at the beginning because he had an interest in Shakespeare as well as because he's always been associated with modern realistic acting, modern plays. But he did, and down in the lobby there's a lot of pictures of Shakespeare productions that Sandy directed. Yeah.
Okay. Who was on the staff then? When did Martha Graham?
Martha Graham, I think, was preceded Sandy's. Martha, I think, was here like when the school was established in 1928.
Uh-huh.
I mean, not here. It was down on Grand Street then in those days. I don't think Sandy really had much to do with the Grand Street place. I think they had already moved uptown before he ever got connected with them. But he was a young actor on Broadway previous to his teaching, was as far as I knew. I mean, that's when he was sort of we have a picture somewhere of him is where he looks like, Franchitone in a Hollywood kind of style picture, that sort of thing.
I remember old Franchitone.
Yeah.
Joan Crawford.
Yeah.
But Martha Graham was here then.
Yes, and she taught. I mean, she was still teaching when I was a student in 1960.
Who else on the staff?
In the early days, there was Martha Graham, Agnes DeMille. I can give you a list. I'll give you a Xerox copy of a list of an early program.
Okay.
A brochure for the school.
That would be good, Harold.
And that'll help you.
Right. When Sandy first started teaching, it wasn't the Meisner method as we know it.
No, of course not. He was still, I think, at least the way he talked to me, and I picked his brains a little bit on it, was that he really was using the students to find a way of how to bring the Stanislavski approach, the Stanislavski famous method that was found in, that Stanislavski worked on at the turn of the century in Russia with the Moscow Art Theater, with Chekhov, and Danchenko. Sandy then was trying to find ways to practice, and I think he, Lee Strasberg, Stella Adler, Harold Klerman, all of them, were doing the same thing. They were using their classes and their students to investigate how this way of work might be translated to an American acting style, which each one of them found their own little way of doing it. And now we have the Meisner technique, the Strasberg technique, the Stella Adler technique. We have all these techniques.
But the Meisner technique, or as people call it, the Meisner method, was really developed here at the neighborhood.
That's right. Right. Yeah. Through students. I suppose you have to include private classes as well, so he's probably working there as well, that were not legitimately theater classes that were a part of the school, but I think he had a little space for those classes and the evenings and stuff, but he also was doing it with the student, day students, yeah.
Explain to me, simply, the Meisner technique.
Well, it's...
go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it takes 2 years to explain it, and then it takes 20 years, as Sandy said, to learn how to do it. But it's getting your attention out of this is especially on the other actor, the actor you're working with, in such a highly concentrated way, you don't have any time left to think about yourself. So you're leaving yourself completely alone. Your focus is over there on your partner. So when your partner throws you a curveball, in an acting sense, you don't have time to say, now, what is the proper way to respond? What is the socially acceptable way to respond? You just respond. And that is really, that's as simple as you can get in describing it, but that's what it is. And the kids here spend almost an entire year working to rid themselves of self-direction. Because most of us, we're born, our parents guide us, direct us, adjust us. Then we go to school, the teachers adjust us, and we end up 16, 17, 18, or 19 as adjusted social human beings. Nothing wrong with that if we're going to sit behind a desk and type a typewriter all day. But it's probably a little too narrow if you want to be an actor, because you want to play a wide range of possibilities, not just the ones that your life has afforded you. So that's why these doors have to be open for actors. You know, I've never been a scumbag heroin dealer standing on the street corner, but he might be fun to play for 10 minutes in a movie, yeah, or on a stage. So as an actor in training, what I want to do is open up a darker side of my nature that life, my life has never afforded me to investigate, so that I can do it in an imaginary world of a movie or a play.
And is this what Sandy calls truth in acting?
Yeah, yeah. And it's connected. Then also what happens as a result of this way of work is what you're releasing is things that are uniquely you, not what society thinks you should be like, but what you really are like.
That's true.
And that's why actors like Robert Duvall and Bobby De Niro and Eli Wallach they're unique. There's nobody else like them, you know. And when they create something, it's created in the truth of who they are. Therefore, you believe them. Whereas other actors who sort of, you know, you're sort of, I call them actors who act from the neck up, the sort of Hollywood boys that you see on television, they're always the same, they're sort of a personality, but you never really feel they reach out and touch you. You know, they're not really connected with who they are.
I remember reading it in Sanford Meisner on acting and watching it in the film that was made out of these one-word exercises. He used to go.
Yeah, that exercise he didn't, that was called, what was called repetition, but he didn't. The repetition exercises he invented in after I was a student. It wasn't until he came back from California that that's when he started doing repetition, either when he was in California or when he came back and started teaching at the AMDA with Philip Burton.
Yeah,
he was there for 2 years before he came back to the neighborhood playhouse. And I think that's when he started that exercise. Now, we did exercises when I was a student and earlier students than me, which achieved the same thing, but they weren't called repetition, you know. That we did other things that didn't. Again, it was the whole idea of a repetition exercise is to get your attention off the words. I mean, if you're saying to be or not to be, that is the question by Shakespeare. If you're doing something that's already written on paper, well, right away you're going up into your head, you're thinking about those words, you're thinking about the meaning of those words. But if you're repeating simply blue shirt, blue shirt, blue shirt, blue shirt, blue shirt, well, it suddenly is meaningless as far as words are concerned, but you still can use those words to express emotionally what you see in the other actor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the principle of the repetition exercise, is what's coming out of your mouth is relatively unimportant, but what you're seeing in the other actor's behavior and commenting on through those words. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Did you read that article, maybe a month ago in the Sunday Times, about David Mamet's author?
Yeah.
What did you think of that?
I think it's, I don't think there's anything wrong with searching for new ways of act, of teaching acting and of acting. I haven't seen any brilliant results of what these people are talking about yet. Maybe it'll come. I still think that the danger in all those things is they become intellectual pursuits instead of heart pursuits. And if there's one thing the theater has to have, and that has to have an actor who reaches out and touches an audience. And if he doesn't touch an audience, then what's the point in having theater? That's my feeling. That's why I'm in the theater, because I believe it's a place where you go, where this stranger on a stage playing King Lear suddenly reaches out and touches you where you live and makes you associate with your own life. And some of these newer practices, they seem a little too clever. But maybe they'll find it. You know, I'm not... new forms come.
Well, I didn't believe very much in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, that's always going to happen. I think it happens in any art form where it changes. People try to make changes, and some of them Some of those, it's like art, you know. It's like Dali. Dali was popular. What's that other thing? I can't think of them. But anyway, the nihilists in art and all that sort of stuff. They had their day, but then suddenly,
well, the only thing that interested me about was that David Mamet made a statement, but he studied here. And I think it helped him become a good playwright.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the repetition game is the basis of most of his writing.
Yeah, but he said in his article, all he wanted actors to do was to read his lines.
Yeah.
But that was David Mamet.
Yeah.
But Sandy, until he died, was changing the method, wasn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, this was about 10 years before he died. In my office here at the Neighborhood Playhouse, one day I said to him, he came in and he would just finish teaching a class upstairs, and I guess he'd been doing repetition and it wasn't going very well. And so he said, you know, I think maybe I'll drop this repetition stuff and not do it anymore. And I said, you can't. You've become world famous for this exercise. You've got to hang on to it. And he laughed. But I mean, all the years that I knew him, he never stopped. And other acting teachers I've known, who will remain nameless, but some of them became fairly big and well-known in this town, insisted that you do it their way. Sandy was always, and his good teachers, still I have good teachers who teach his work, they put people on path roads of discovery. They don't tell people how to do it. And that, to me, has always been what a good teacher is about anyway. And that's what Sandy's brilliance was that he could watch you up there doing your work and with three sentences pinpoint what your problem was specifically.
Yes,
unlike anybody else in the class.
That was like Sandy's genius.
That was his genius. He could just, you know, nail you to the wall. It might be horrific and you might tremble for the next 3 days, but you knew it was absolutely true.
You know, Harold, I'm very loyal to David Playhouse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is the neighborhood today still teaching the Meisner?
Yeah. Yeah. Our principles are based on all Sandy's work, of course.
Who was the
acting? Richard Pinter is the head of the acting department.
Did he study with Sandy?
Yeah, for 2 years. Yeah, mm-hmm. He was here in the 60s, 65 to 67, I think it was. He was here at the same time. Diane Keaton and he were in the same class.
Oh, I see. He looked familiar. Yeah. Familiar. I don't know.
You might want to talk to him because he's very, he's very fond of. He's a staunch supporter of the Meisner technique.
I will talk.
He and Sandy didn't get along at all. They were like this.
But you see, what I'm trying to do now, I have one of two agents. One is somebody who...
Yeah, I know you want to send out some packet. Here. Yeah, here's an idea now. Can I do more, please? Give me money to do more.
I want to get money up front.
Sure, I don't blame you.
I'm not going to go through this.
No, what's the point? What's the point?
What impact, now if these questions have no relation.
Yeah. No, it sounds good.
What impact did Sandy have on you as an actor?
On me? Well, I never, of course, I came here, I wasn't even interested. I knew somehow that I wasn't going to end up being an actor, even when I came here. I knew that I wanted to direct. I wanted to be a good professional director. And therefore, I knew I had to go to an acting school and study acting because I had to understand what an actor was about. I suppose those are the areas of truth and looking at each actor as an individual is probably the thing that most affected me about in Sandy. You know, being Sandy's assistant and sitting beside
How
him
long
for
were you Sandy's assistant?
Two or three years. I can't remember now for sure.
What impact, Harold, does Sandy have on you as a person?
As a person. Well, at the time, I used to get very mad at him, frustrated with him, because sometimes I felt he was stubborn. But it's like Mrs. Morgenthau said when Sandy, Sandy didn't tell her he was going to California.
No.
And he just had taken the job at 20th Century Fox and didn't bother to tell her that he wasn't going to be here next year. Mm-hmm. This was like in the summer. She found out from a student. It's just awful. I mean, typical of Sandy. I mean, and so then she said, he will never be at the Neighborhood Playhouse again ever. You know, this was 1957, 58. And she was really angry, just, furious with him. So then he came back from California 4 or 5, 6 years later, and he was at AMDA and talked to Paul, and Paul wanted him to come back to the Playhouse. So Paul approached Mrs. Morgenthau, and Mrs. Morgenthau said, no, he was never, after what he did to me, he will never come back. And Paul said he left her apartment on 50th Street, walked up to his on 59th Street, and by the time he got to his apartment, his phone was ringing, and Mrs. Morgenthau said, yeah, well, I know he's a bastard, but we got to have him because he's good. He's a good teacher. You know, it's a very good story, and it's very much what we all did with Sandy. We put up with a lot of shit.
This is what I wanted to warn you know.
Oops. You know, that's okay. I think in many ways he had this brilliance. Well, I don't know. You see, I think genius quite often is associated with self-destruction. Mm-hmm. And I always had a feeling that there was a lot of that going on with him there. Well, I mean, you know, just from your family relations, when his two wives, and then suddenly he decides he's not straight, he's not heterosexual, he's homosexual. I mean, that's not happy to begin with. To be, you know, whichever way it wasn't quite an honest way of dealing with it. As a personal man, he was bitter. And got more bitter, I think. And then, of course, the things that the diseases did to him, I think, made him more bitter, you know, personally. But the only time I saw him come really alive and happy was when he was teaching. I mean, he was a born teacher. None of that stuff was in the classroom unless somebody did something ridiculous, and then he would really give it to them. But you know what I mean? When he was teaching, he was a happy man.
Because I never knew Sandy.
Yeah.
Sandy and I think my whole family was so. Well, my mother, not my father. My mother, my sister, and I were such in awe of this great man.
Yeah, because he was that much older than you too. Yeah.
And he was no one in the family. None of us related. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and he was a very remote personality. You know, somebody. This actor, for example, asked me, "What can you tell me about when you saw Mr. Meisner come into a room?" I said, oh, that's easy. I said, he always came in with looking at the ceiling, and then once he was in the room, he disdained to look and find out who else was in the room. I said, I told Sandy this. It wasn't something I ever hid. I told Sandy once, I said, you know, you were born out of your century. You should have been born a decadent duke in France, you know, where you could look, you could have lace and all that stuff and look down your nose at the peasants, you know, because he had that. It wasn't an affectation. It wasn't phony. It was part of him, you know.
And he was a very quiet man too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You know. Mm-hmm. And not a man who wanted a lot of attention either. I mean, that video that Bob, what's his name, Sidney Pollack, best kept secret. Because he wasn't a PR, any good at PR or publicity for himself, you know. In fact, he was terrible about that. When you compare him to Lee Strasberg and some of these other people who got their name in every paper every day, yeah. Sandy could care less about that.
He always cared less about himself.
Yeah, yeah.
In those terms.
In those kind of, he wasn't a pushy ego in that sense, but he had an ego. He had an ego.
Yeah.
You had to respect his work.
Or what he believed in.
Yes, yeah. He had tremendous. And, yeah.
Did he ever show temper with the students?
Oh yes, yeah. I mean, he would kick people out of school. He would say, you know, even after when I was the head of the school and he was teaching here in the 80s, occasionally he'd send somebody down and they'd come knocking on my door and Mr. Meisner tells me I have to leave school, you know, because whatever they did, it was so stupid or something, and then probably he would forgive them. You know, I would have to calm them down and wipe their tears, and then. Then I'd set up a meeting with him and them, and probably at the end of that they would be back in class. But for the most, usually that's what happened.
But did he act like that because they did something?
I think they were object lessons most times. Mm-hmm. You know, get that shit. And you're bringing it. This is the third time you've brought it to me, and I'm going to teach you.
Out.
You're out. You're out of the school. You know. The funniest story I have on Sandy and is, he directed a play called The Chief Thing. And this would be in the late 60s or early 70s. George Loris was in it. George is now a teacher over at the Lee Strasberg Institute. And there, he unwisely, I thought at the time, brought somebody from his private class in to play the lead. And whether the students then supported this guy. And unfortunately, this guy wasn't a very good actor, right? And so Sandy was frustrated about that. Sandy arrives at the theater, walks into the back of the theater, and the play had just started, and this guy appears on stage, and without asking Sandy, he'd added a rug to the roof of his head, put on a wig. And Sandy said, "Hal," to me, "go backstage and turn out the lights." No, we had a full audience. I said, "I can't do that." He said, "Turn out those goddamn lights. That actor doesn't deserve to be seen." and he kept it up for 5 minutes, and I kept saying, no. And finally, he left to go have a vodka. I didn't turn off the light.
And the play went on.
The play went on. But I mean, but that was his reaction to this.
It sounds almost as if Sandy really didn't have regard sometimes for people.
Yeah, in certain ways, he didn't. And he was a teacher. I suppose the other thing that I think very, very, very few people understand, he was a teacher, he was not a director.
Mm-hmm.
Although he directed a lot of plays, but I think he found it distasteful. I don't think he enjoyed bringing things to their finished. I think he really enjoyed working on process, but not working on finished, you know? And he quite often, many nights when I was assisting him, he'd come in and he'd work for an hour and a half on the first two moments of a scene of a play that was 2 hours long that had to open next week. But he'd spend 2 hours on the first two, you know, just repeating the first two moments, working on them, and until he got tired, and then he'd turn to me and say, "I'm going home, you finish the rest of it." You know, because it didn't interest him.
Harold, did you ever have violent arguments with Sandy?
Not.
You don't have to answer.
No, I didn't really. A lot of people did.
Yeah.
I think the reason I didn't, because I was never one of his boys.
Yeah.
Nearly all the other teachers who were his assistants got their jobs by being a student of his. And then he would ask them to become an assistant to learn how to teach. I was Paul's assistant. I came in to him in a very different way. I had been here with David Pressman and Paul previously when Sandy was away. So I was already part of that. And so somehow Sandy always talked to me. He never tried to lord it over me.
You know,
and we always talked back and forth. And I think Paul was what he respected Paul. I mean, and Paul, I think, would have laid down on the floor and let Sandy walk over him. I mean, you know,
I love Paul.
Paul was just the sweetest guy.
I love Paul. And you know, Paul related to me.
There's his picture there. I keep it right there.
I saw that one.
I just keep it there.
Paul related to me better than Sandy did.
Yeah.
You know,
he did to most people, actually. Paul was
the
warmest person.
Public school, he drew a picture of me in my head.
Yeah.
I hope you look like this 1900 or something like that.
Yeah, Paul's wonderful.
Just a couple more questions.
Yeah, sure.
Are you happy the way this interview is going?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, sure.
Harold, what is the difference between him, Strasberg, and Methodist?
Well, I can tell you what he said when he was forced to answer that question. He didn't like to answer it much, but the things he didn't like that Strasberg worked on was parts of that Stanislavski. See, the problem with Stanislavski is there are these books which were written at the turn of the century about a kind of theater that was in existence in Russia in the 19th century, a kind of acting style that none of us ever saw. But then people, for some reason, still to this day, take those books and read them as if they're talking about the acting you're seeing on television or in the movies. You know, Stanislavski wasn't talking about the same kind of problems. Those were people who were acting in these big theaters with these kinds of voices and all that kind of stuff, which was all right in the 19th century because you had those 2,000 seat houses where you had to have voices like Chelyabin and whatever. Anyway, so that was part of the problem, was there was this misunderstanding of what the man wrote about, And he wrote everything down, I think, Stanislavski. And later in his life, he disavowed a lot of the stuff he put in the books. Mm-hmm. And one of them was emotional recall. And emotional recall is digging into yourself and remembering the day that your little doggy died.
Yeah,
and a lot of the Strasberg work has to do with sense memory, remembering what it was like or what a taste was like or all these things, or remembering what really happened to you and dredging up.
So you can create the emotion?
Yeah. Not that every actor doesn't use that. I mean, it's there, we're going to use it. I mean, I'm going to be affected by the death of my mother. I'm going to be affected by the death of my dog when I'm 5 years old. All those things are going to be a part of me, and as an actor, I'm sure I use them. What Sandy said was that many times when you go into your own life in a search of something that really happened, you may only be setting up a block. And so it makes it more difficult to get that emotion because you're dealing with something that really happened. You're dealing with your real mother or your real father or whatever. What he says, there's a much richer place than your own life, and that's your imagination. And that was the difference. Sandy always pushed students into their imagination. Sandy's big tool in the second year work, well, actually in the second half of the first year they bring it in, was how you can use your imagination to bring up an emotion through what he called, in a very simple thing, daydreaming. We can all daydream. This is how Sandy put it. He said, how much better than really trying to remember the day your dog really died, why not fantasize on what it would be like if your dog died when you were 5 years old? And so he felt that was much healthier. And I tend to agree that that's a much healthier way, because the other one, the Strasberg way of working, to me, gets you too neurotic. It turns you in on your own. It becomes psychiatric instead of, and what actors are about is entertaining, of sending it out, not turning it in on themselves. And you know, that's what I always, my criticism of the last Strasberg actors, including the great ones like Brando and James Dean and those, were that they tended to act for nobody else but themselves. Sandy's work did not feel that was part of it. Not that you wouldn't use those parts yourself. They're there. You use them. But this would be a much healthier way to work using your imagination.
Carol, I'm going to thank you. I'm very impressed. Very impressed with this interview. I think you've given me a lot.
Okay. Well, good.
Okay, Harold. You can tell me something about me. You told me the story of Sandy with his walking in.
Yeah.
I like that story.
Yeah.
If you could tell me the story about the chair, and also repeat whatever little you told me about Sandy came in to see you one day and says, I'm going to stop playing.
Oh,
the
yeah, movie. Right, okay.
That story. Yeah. Okay.
Well, the story I was thinking about was that there was the acting classrooms at the neighborhood playhouse have, bits of furniture for the students to use for scenes, which they rearrange from scene to scene or from exercise to exercise. And quite often, they make their way to that classroom because a student finds them on the street on the way to school, and they bring them up to the classroom and they get left there. Well, there was this one woe-begone chair that was like a rattan chair with arms, but it was falling apart, and it was there for months. And every day that Sandy came in to teach his class, he would stop, fix his glare on this chair, obviously, which he hated the look of, but then he would go on about his business and teach the class and leave. So this went on for several, I would think a couple of months anyway, and every day Sandy eyed this chair. And then there was one day, and I was his assistant at the time, this was in the 60s, there was one day he came and he stopped and stood there longer than usual, and then he went over and the whole class was watching him. It was spring. The windows were open. And he picked up the chair, walked over to the window, and dropped it out and out the window. The day had come when he couldn't stand it anymore. He said, I'm getting rid of that. Didn't say a word. Students didn't say a word. He went over and sat down and started teaching the class.
Funny story.
But it was a wonderful story.
Yeah.
This fixation on this awful chair.
Do you recall, Harold, any reactions from students from Sandy? They reacted Sandy might have been severe with them.
Yeah, I mean, and he was also a devil, too. I mean, he loved kidding, you know, the girls especially. I remember a girl came running in one morning and ran up to his desk and said to him, Mr. Meisner, I had a dream about you last night. And there was a pause, and then he looked at her, and his eyes twinkled, and he said, how was I?
That's funny.
That's a good one.
That's funny. Do students come in sometimes and complain to you, or...
Oh, yeah, sometimes we get, you know, and sometimes somebody would do something absolutely ridiculous, and Sandy would say, get out. You're out of school.
Mm-hmm.
Don't come back. And so then they would come down with, you know, tears streaming down their face to see me, and then I would say, well, just wait out here until he comes out of class and let's talk to him. So then I would talk to them. Usually he would say first, no, that person should leave. They're no good. But then he would usually change his mind within 10 minutes and say, okay, they can come back tomorrow. But it was like a lesson he was giving them for doing something that was thoughtless or really, you know, something that had been taught and they should not by now know. I mean, it was those kinds of things.
I think Tony Randall had a hard time with Sandy.
Could be.
Because Tony says, one thing I wanted in my life, which I never got, was Sandy telling me I'm a good actor. And he said he would never tell me that, he says. Never would tell me that.
Yeah.
And then he went on to
say...
Well,
I never heard him tell very many people that in so many words. I mean, he would imply it. He would say something about maybe one thing you did that was very good. But the rest of it was no good. It was like it was negated. So... but, you know, I never heard him, he wasn't overly big with his praise, but boy, he sure knew how to tell you what was wrong.
Yes.
And not always nastily either, sometimes in a very constructive way. The thing about Sandy's teaching that I always admired was the fact that he knew what you needed to hear today. Which made him, I think, a genius of a teacher, is because he had a sense of what that kid should walk out of that room with today and think about tonight and come back and try to fix tomorrow. I saw it again and again and again. He said, now here, don't pay any attention to the rest of this problem you got, but work on this. And I've never seen a teacher as good at that as he was. That was always my amazement with Sandy, that he saw the individual always.
Yes.
He never, you know, just taught generally. And that was where his brilliance came from as a teacher.
Tony also said, by the way, I could never act in front of Sandy.
You know, a lot of people, I mean, felt that because of the great man and the terror of what he might say or what he might do. There's still... Somebody was in our workshop last week. Somebody got up to do something in the room where Sandy taught, and they said, "Oh my God, I'm back in this room. I'm scared again."
That's a funny story.
It stayed with them. Yeah.
Yes, this was an actor who studied with Sandy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. And he says, "I haven't acted in this room since Sandy was here, and now here am I, and I'm terrified again."
Remember what year?
That girl would have been here in the 80s.
In the 80s.
Near the end of his teaching, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned something about Sandy coming into you one day and saying, Harold, I'm not going to play it straight anymore. Remember that?
When?
He came in one day, as you said.
Yeah. And he wasn't going to...
He was just going to be homosexual.
Oh. Yeah, I don't know if he said actually that in so much words, but he said maybe I shouldn't worry about it anymore or something.
Did he worry about it anymore?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. He never talked to me much about it at all.
You know, I haven't talked to anybody, I think not.
I think he was very close-mouthed about that, about his private life. And I wouldn't be one he would talk to because I was married and I was kind of had a family and, you know, I was from a different kind of... So I don't know that that would... I would be a person he would confide in anyway.
Did Sandy ever talk to you about me or our family?
I remember him telling, talking about, well, different times. I remember him telling me about when his brother died, that
yes.
story. He quite often talked about it. He, in acting class, he quite often talked about it. And he talked about his mother, I know. I don't remember too much else.
I think he loved her very much.
Yeah, I think so.
And she was a tough, horrible
tough
lady.
Tough lady, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think they had to be in those days too, didn't they? I mean, just to...
She was a vain, tough lady.
Yeah, was she?
Very beautiful lady,
uh-huh.
but very tough. Yeah. I'll never forget when she died. I was in her apartment in Forest Hill. Sandy had left about a half an hour or so, maybe an hour before. And I called up and spoke to Jimmy. And I said, my mother died. And I heard Jimmy say, Sandy, your mother died. Then I heard these horrible shrieks. Shrieks?
Uh-huh.
You mean like...
Uh-huh.
And he said, and Jimmy says, don't touch anything, he's coming right back. So he came back, went inside, looked at my mother, and never... That was his grieving. That was it. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's a, you know... Because our mother is something special for any one of us.
Yeah. I think he was had problems with my father. Because
mm-hmm.
I think my father didn't want him to be an actor.
Right.
He wanted him to be a furrier or something.
Something like that. Something
yeah.
that made money.
Yeah. Not an actor.
Yeah, right.
But,
yeah.
And Sandy says in his book about he came home when I said I'm going to be an actor.
Right.
But I don't remember that. I
right. You would be too young.
Yeah.
yeah.
Probably about six, but
yeah.
I don't.
You wouldn't remember.
I don't remember that at all. Harold, I have no other questions.
Yeah, and I can't think. I was trying to think if there's anything else I could tell you. But that seems to me to be things I remember anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you think of something,
yeah,
let me know. I now have a tape recorder that I can put on my
phone,
telephone.
Oh, that's good.
But I don't want to do interviews that way.
I like to talk to people. I don't
people
blame you. Yeah.
Back and forth. I'm just going to remind you, Harold. And I know you're very, very busy.
Yeah. So I'll look, get, see, what think about a student. I'm going to write it down.
Student.
Yeah. And
get me files of people. And a letter from you introducing Sandy.
Yeah, you need addresses. And
yes.
And phone numbers if possible.
And then with the student, I will come in. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
But
I'll
if
see
it's minimal work, I'll pay him 100.
Yeah.
If it's more, 10 bucks.
That, I wouldn't think it would be any more than that.
Yeah, but... But I don't, again, I would love to get it as quickly as I
yeah.
can, you know.
Yeah,
and you'll speak
because
to
you'd like to work on it.
Yeah. And you'll speak to Whitehead. I'd like to do Whitehead as soon as I
yeah.
can, because then
well, I'll... Well, I'll be talking to him, I hope, within the next week or so.
I have
so
an agent,
so.
You can tell him, and looks good for
yeah.
my publishing book, you see.
Yeah.
And I'm getting old, too, Harold.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, well,
you're not that old. You're in
no,
good shape.
I'm a kid.
Yeah.
Thanks
okay,
much.
Great.
I just want to be sure I got it.